Mr. Blagg, you're with us today. Do either council have any questions before we begin? Thank you very much. Mr. Canella, you may proceed.
May I please the court? My name is Robert Canella, along with Gerald Fredrickson. I'm co-counsel for Lori and Robert Bogue. In this medical malpractice case, the Bogues appeal from a summary judgment granted in favor of Dr. Christopher Gillis, a neurosurgeon. On January 17th, 2017, Dr. Gillis performed spinal fusion surgery on Mrs. Bogue. During that back surgery, he negligently injured Mrs. Bogue's left ureter, and as a result, she lost her left kidney in March of 2018. The record shows that Dr. Gillis treated the resulting complications from Mrs. Bogue's back surgery as her admitting or attending physician through at least January 19th, 2018. This malpractice action was filed within 2 years after that date. The affidavit testimony of the Bogue's medical expert was that Dr. Gillis had been negligent during the surgery, and had he not been, Mrs. Bogue's ureter and kidney more likely than not would not have been injured. The expert's affidavit also testified that the complications for which Dr. Gillis continued to follow Mrs. Bogue were caused by him in the surgery and I quote here, all of Dr. Gillis's treatment after surgery was related to the surgical negligence.
Before you go further into this, and I see you're heading toward the continuing treatment argument, but I just want to clarify that there's no contention here that this case is governed by the State Tort Claims Act and the statutes of limitations set forth in that act.
That's correct. This is strictly an action directly against Dr. Gillis.
And that's...
The other defendants were dismissed out, and so it's just basically
and
a straight.
So, Dr. Gillis, you concede, is governed by either 25-222 or the special medical malpractice statute of limitations, State Tort Claims Act is.
That's correct. Not something you're allowed. That's correct.
At the time you filed the motion, or at the time you filed the original complaint, or maybe the operative complaint, did you believe this was a State Tort Claims Act case? And if so, is that relevant to our statute of limitations analysis?
Initially, yes, we did believe that, but we determined that Dr. Gillis was not an employee of a state or political subdivision entity. So it just, we were left with just a lawsuit against Dr. Gillis.
Where are all the other defendants?
They've all been dismissed out, either by order of the court or by operation of the law. There was at least one of them that was never served. So the statute would take that defendant out automatically.
And so you are conceding, I hear, that the State Tort Claims Act statute of limitations framework should not inform our analysis at all.
Correct.
All right.
This action was then filed against Dr. Gillis and the other defendants within 2 years after he last treated Mrs. Bogue on January 19th of 2018. Nevertheless, the district court held that the action was barred by the 2-year statute of limitations, either the professional negligence one or the hospital medical liability act one, and I believe it was the latter.
Is there any evidence in the record or evidence from which a reasonable inference could flow that there was negligent treatment of the complications?
No, I cannot say that there was, Your Honor. But I'm about to say, I don't think it matters.
I anticipate that.
I'll go on. There's some inconsistency. Well, this is an appeal only involving Dr. Gillis and only asserting the continuing treatment exception. And there's some inconsistency in the Nebraska decisions regarding that exception. In Healy versus Langdon, this court in 1994, this court stated the rule in this way, and I'll quote, in medical malpractice cases, the period of limitations or repose begins to run when the treatment rendered after and relating to the allegedly wrongful act or omission is completed. Healy went on to answer what it means for the subsequent treatment to be related to the original negligence. And if I paraphrase it, the distinction was, if the subsequent treatment relates to complications resulting from the original negligence, then the statute of limitations does not begin to run until the completion of the subsequent treatment. That's consistent with Williams versus Elias, the rationale behind it, which is to give the physician or surgeon time to correct his mistakes without being harassed by premature litigation.
So would you agree we have two separate streams of case law on continuous treatment as it relates to medical malpractice?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. And I think the Eighth Circuit panel decision that we cited in our petition to bypass kind of said we have a hard time with these Nebraska cases.
I beg your pardon, since the Joyner case to which you refer, have we continued to be on two separate paths?
Yes, it is.
And Joyner was in 1996?
I could look, but that sounds right.
Sounds about right. So in any event, we continue to have these perhaps inconsistent paths. Is that your point then?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So what's your argument as to which path we should take and why?
I don't know that they're totally inconsistent in the sense that I was about to get to the Frizzell case, which says in order to have the continuing treatment doctrine apply, there either has to be treatment pursuant to a misdiagnosis or pursuant to a negligent course of continuing treatment. And I think that is still good law as far as it goes, but I don't think it captures the entirety of the continuing treatment exception as this court interpreted it in Healy versus Langdon, in Smith versus Dewey, and in Tywalt versus Dewey. In Healy, Justice White took the Smith case and the Tywalt case and he harmonized them and set forth the rule that he and the court deduced from those two cases,
but didn't cite Frizzell.
But didn't cite Frizzell, as I recall. And there have been multiple cases since then citing Healy for exactly that rule that Justice White set forth. But as far as I'm able to determine, this court has never cited Frizzell for the proposition that you have to have a continuing course of negligent treatment for the continuing treatment exception to apply.
How would you argue for the version of the continuous treatment doctrine that you argue for? How would you argue that that can be squared with the statutes?
Obviously, it does not literally fall within either one of those two statutes of limitations. However, I think you could argue several answers to that question, which are that, number one, the court has already carved out the exception. Those statutes were enacted in 1972 and 76 initially. The court has continued to apply the continuing treatment exception since then, the rule that I'm arguing for.
Should we have?
I think we were headed towards legislative acquiescence.
That's where I was headed.
All right.
And have they acquiesced in both lines of authority? And if so, what do we do with that?
They probably acquiesced in both lines of authority. And so, I mean, the bottom line of our argument is somehow we believe that the cases should be harmonized and Frizzell can probably stand as it is, but it needs to be somehow modified so as to be consistent with Healy.
How would you suggest we do that? I mean, isn't Frizzell this exact case? It's negligence alleged during surgery years after the doctor's treating complications, and then the plaintiff saying start the clock when the treatment for the complication ends, and this court said no, we're not going to do that, there wasn't any negligence in treating the complications.
Well, just I don't think this case wasn't years after. She saw Dr. Gillis four times during the succeeding 13 months or so.
Same thing in Frizzell, as I recall.
Well, if Frizzell is the rule, if that's really the rule, then why have a continuing treatment exception? If it's a pursuant to a misdiagnosis, if the continuing treatment is pursuant to a misdiagnosis, then every treatment is negligent. The statute's never going to run out until those treatments stop. And if there has to be a continuing course of negligent treatment, then every one of those negligent acts is a negligent act that restarts the statute of limitations. That's why I don't think Frizzell can be the entirety of the rule. I think the cases have to be harmonized. And as I said, this court in its recent jurisprudence has relied on and applied the Healy rule much more than the Frizzell rule. And I know that the appellee cites Smith versus Dewey 8 times in their brief, but they never cite the critical part of Smith versus Dewey, which was something to the effect of, if the continuing treatment alleged had been a follow-up to the original treatment, then this action would be timely. I see my time is up. I have a lot more to say, but unless you have questions, I will be seated. And I'm not sure I have any rebuttal, but if I do, I would ask to reserve it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Blagg, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. I am Dave Blagg. I am here representing the appellant, and it's also nice to be here on 2-2-2-2. It's kind of a symmetrical date. I do have to disagree with one thing that's been said, and I don't think that there are actually two lines of authority. When I started researching this case, I was looking at it, and then I said, does this fit together? And ultimately came to the conclusion that it does. What we've got is a citement of a general rule of the continuing treatment doctrine, but we got to look at the fine points of when it's been applied. And that is, Frizzell has said that it only applies in two separate circumstances, the misdiagnosis circumstance or continuing negligence. And there has never been a case decided by this court that applies it in any other way.
Healy versus Langdon?
Right. Because Healy versus Langdon, and I initially was confused by that. First thing we got to note, Healy versus Langdon is an informed consent case. And we'll get to that in just a second, but I want to look at, and I'm going to consult my notes so that I do it correctly, is you look at the paragraph where we're drawing that distinction. It says, if the subsequent treatment related to the unwarned treatment, then the statute of limitations did not begin to run until the completion of the subsequent treatment, citing Smith. Smith holds the statute of limitations begins to run under the continuous treatment doctrine at the end of the treatment, which plaintiff claims to have been malpractice. That's the informed consent situation. Informed consent's a little weird, because what the action is you didn't tell me about this. If you would have told me about this, I never would have had the treatment. And then I never would have had this side effect, so I wouldn't be having treatments for this side effect. So every time that treatment occurs that would have not happened but for them telling them about it, is a negligent act.
But you could have an unwarned treatment for which informed consent is not provided, and then complications develop, and the same physician could treat the complications and get proper consent to treat the complications, and that wouldn't be negligence.
No, because there's no negligence at all in that particular
case. No, I'm asking you to stipulate that there's initial failure to obtain informed consent.
If there's initial failure to obtain informed consent and there's no continuing course of treatments?
There is a continuing course of treatments.
If there's a continuing course,
complications develop and then the physician treats the complication.
Then what I'm saying in that situation, in order to complete the cause of action for informed consent, each one of those treatments is part of the negligent act, because the theory is you would have told me I never would have had this treatment, I'd never be having these subsequent treatments. So they are part of negligence and informed consent. It's one tort. Every time you have a treatment, no matter when it occurs in informed consent case, you've got a case of negligence, because it never would have occurred but for the fact that you didn't warn me.
And what's the best case that I can read that that capsulizes the argument you've just been making?
You can't.
I had that suspicion.
Yes, I think part of the problem is that we've got this general rule that gets cited all the time in these cases, the continuing treatment doctrine. But then you read the facts of the case that it's cited in and you go, it's irrelevant. We just threw it out.
We have the general rule, but we also have this language from Williams versus Elias that keeps popping up about the rationale, and the rationale being, we want to give, you know, the physician-patient relationship is really important and we want to preserve it. And we want to give the doctor a chance to fix his or her mistakes. And that language isn't consistent with the version of the continuing treatment doctrine you're arguing for.
And I think that Fresnel said, well, no, there's limitations on that, and it came later. Also, the problem with the Williams case is Williams decided when the statute of limitations was based on the concept of accrual. And then with the new statutes, both the professional liability 25222 and 442828, if I'm right, we switched to the concept of the statute of limitations running from the act. So that doesn't apply. And you also, under the Williams, run into the fact that if you continue to extend the statute of limitations by having a related treatment, a prudent physician who thinks he or she might have screwed up is going to go, I ain't seeing this person because I'm just extending the statute of limitations. So you have the direct opposite effect. Under the Fresnel rule, if a physician makes a mistake and then engages in a course of treatment that is not negligent to help them, the statute of limitations still continues to run. But under the circumstance that we're trying to do now, if the physician makes a mistake and tries to help the patient out, they continue to push the statute of limitations down the road. So if they came to my office and said, look, I got the situation, I don't know, messed up, should I see him? My answer would be, as a lawyer, I got to tell you, no, stay away. You're being set up. So I don't think, the other thing about Williams that I think we have to look at, that of course is not in the record, but times have changed with regard to medicine's practice. We're now in an age of specialization where things switch. We're not in a situation where you have the nice hometown physician who delivered the baby, did the surgery, does all the follow-up. No, you're being shoved all over the place. So I don't think the rationale in Williams applies. I think we continue to cite it, but I don't think it applies. And I also think that by Fresnel, it was cut off.
Can the Williams rationale of let's give the doctor a chance to fix mistakes, can that be squared with 25222 and the medical malpractice statute of limitations that came after them?
I do not think so, because they changed the language. As I said, when Williams was decided, the concept of the statute of limitations and the statutes was based on when an action accrued, which is kind of a subject, you know, when does something accrue? But now the specific language of the statute refers to the act. And I don't think it can be. And I think if we extend the continuing treatment doctrine, and I mentioned this in the brief, down the road that we're looking at, you run square into how does this fit within the current statute? What are you doing with the language? And again, I apologize because I don't have the statute memorized, but that language that we're talking about is it shall be commenced within 2 years next after the alleged act or omission in rendering or failing to rend professional services, providing the basis for such action. And if we go to the idea that if, as long as we have a related treatment, we've untethered it from the action that that it's based on. It's no longer based on the act or omission that gives rise to the cause of action. It's based on an act related to an act that gave rise to the cause. And then you go down that road. What about one that's related to the one that's related to the one that's related to the basis? And we can keep extending it. And as I mentioned in the brief, it literally gives the patient, unless the doctor refuses to see them, the ability to extend the statute of limitations. And in Smith versus Dewey, when the court was met with that argument with regard to the statute of repose, it said, we're not going to allow that to happen We're not going to let them come in here every 9.5 years and keep shoving the statute of repose off, and we'd be in the same place. The other question is sort of a philosophical one that I think you have to look at is if we're going to say now, we're not going to focus on the professional services providing the basis for such action, but on things related to that, why is it only running in one way? What if you have a course of treatment and then negligence? Why didn't the statute of limitations start running at the first related treatment? Why is this only going this way? Because you're philosophically saying relation pulls it in. Well, then we've got to look at it both ways, I think. And that to me makes absolutely no sense, but I'm saying that's what we have to look at. So I think the bottom line here is that I think all of the cases do fit together if you read them carefully. And in my brief, I went through a number of them that cited and said, here's the facts of this and why it fits under the doctrine. But I also think that trying to expand it, change the law, would cause these problems both with the statute and both with the idea that a patient can perpetually extend the statute of limitations. And I don't think the unicameral intended that when it focused on basis for such action as being the trigger for the statute of limitations. It would have used other language, occurrence, accrual, but it didn't use that language.
I have one factual question.
Sure.
Do you contest that the plaintiff's expert's affidavit adequately alleges that the subsequent treatment was for complications? Do you accept that characterization?
I don't think that's the characterization. He said that the subsequent treatment was for what happened. I don't think complication is the word, but I will concede that that affidavit establishes that that subsequent treatment based on the record was related to the surgery. Thank you. I will concede that.
What did the court rule on that?
On
the issue of the January 18th, 2018 treatment. Didn't the court say it was dealing with the collection of fluid, but it wasn't part of the negligent surgical procedure?
Right. What the court said is it focused on, and I don't know, it was like an abscess language that they used, and I don't understand what they're talking about. But I think what the court was saying in the context of that is that he was confirming there's no allegation of negligence with regard to that subsequent treatment. If there's nothing else, I'll take my leave and thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal, counsel. That concludes arguments on Bogue versus University of Nebraska Medical Center. You are excused. Thank you for being here today. Court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Florence Lake Investments versus Berg. Justice Papik is recused from this matter. Court will be joined by District Court Judge Durr.